Good evening, everybody. This is James McCanney with my Science Hour for January 6, 2022. The full name of the show, the James McCanney Science Hour at the Crossroads, airing now in its 22nd year. And this year, this is the first show of 2022, and I'm going to spend the entire year discussing the history of my work. And this is a very important topic because a lot of times when you see scientific discoveries or mathematical discoveries, etc., you don't really have information of what led up to those discoveries. In the history of the author or the scientist, mathematician, or whatever, you don't really understand how this fit in. How did this person get to this point? Why were they looking in this direction? And so, along with studying physics in my background and engineering and electricity and magnetism and all the other topics that go with it, mathematics, I have a equally good education in mathematics as I do in physics. But the thing is, I also studied the history of science. And in studying the history of science, you start to understand how developments came along. For example, you know that Kepler came first, and then the understanding that orbits of planets were out there. They went around the sun, and the Copernican system, it took 300 years for that to become installed. And then there's Isaac Newton, who had just a plethora of amazing discoveries. And you can see these as they develop. So if you study the history of science, you can understand that, of course, Newton would not have understood about, say, prisms and the breaking of light if it were not for the development of glass and the ability to form prisms, etc. So anyway, all of this is important to understand the development of science. So what I did is I not only studied science and the history of science, but I studied the outstanding problems. What are the big major problems that were not solved? And then in some cases, people thought the problems were solved, but they weren't. They had theories that were totally incorrect. So trying to sort this out in the hodgepodge of, you might just call it misinformation in the scientific world, because it becomes very political. And I'll be talking about the Big Bang theory here, and general relativity, which became a giant political football. The Eddington experiments that were done to verify general relativity were basically faked. He cherry-picked the data, and then Eddington, by proving general relativity, which Einstein was very much opposed to, he knew that there was something really wrong here, but Eddington became a world-famous figure in physics. And when we go back and look at his data, cherry picking the data means you pick only the data points that work for your theory and you throw all the other ones out. Well, he cherry picked only maybe 5% of the data points for the bending of light around the sun during this early 1900s eclipse of the sun. And now it's so ingrained in the structure of physics, the general relativity, removing it is a very difficult thing to do. So anyway, the point I'm making here is, as I take you through my discoveries, I had to sort out. I had to put on a thinking cap and understand which things were real, which things were not real. And once I broke through that veil of incorrect science and I started seeing on the other side, there's a very famous drawing, and this is back in the days in the Middle Ages when it was taught that the sky was a firmament and the stars were glued on them and the planets moved along the firmament. And the moon and the sun moved along the firmament as if they were like attached to it. But anyway, there's this drawing, and there's this like young person, and he's breaking out of the firmament. And he's like halfway in and halfway out. And here's the world down here. And he's halfway out, and he's seeing the rest of the universe out there. And it's one of those wake-up moments where as I said, it took hundreds of years, literally, for the teachings, because these went along with papal teachings, the teachings of the Catholic Church, which was essentially given to man from God. And so when they said that the sun revolved around the earth, that was God talking to them. And so anyway, the structure of what you might call knowledge or belief systems has had a dramatic impact on thought throughout the ages. And so what I had to do, and I'll just have a caveat here, because the reason I'm going through this history is not only to expel myths from the as I found them, but also I want to have young people understand that when you go out and actually do something in the realm of science, I'm not talking about physics 101 where you have objects rolling down an inclined plane or angular momentum. That physics is very sound. But when you get into astronomy and they start having theoretical work that is unfounded, like comets, like the development of galaxies, like the Big Bang, like general relativity, when you get into that realm, now you get into a political world where you cannot say anything bad about this theoretical structure. And so people become, they get PhDs in astronomy, astrophysics, or space science. They move through the system. They become a postdoc. Then they get a job. And now they're locked into a system where if they say something against the established system, they're simply tossed out. And what are they going to do? They're married. They have a job. The kids they want to send to college. They want to have retirement. They want to be able to use the good equipment. So they just keep their mouth shut, if they ever wake up to the fact that a lot of what they're propounding is really bogus. Okay, so anyway, I'll be talking about the discoveries in my own history of what I did and to develop the plasma discharge comet model and the just myriad of things that go along with that. For example, diamonds from outer space. Where do those come from? Well, you have carbon-carbon bonds, which are broken by ultraviolet light. So you have, around the head of a comet, you have atomic carbon. And then you have electrical discharges. And that, in the laboratory, is how they make artificial diamonds. And so the traditional belief that diamonds were made deep in the ground under tremendous pressure and then brought up to the surface with volcanic action simply is not true. It's simply not true. And it plays into the hands of the people who control the diamond industry in the world. As long as they can keep it the belief that diamonds are only found in these very few spots, or the same way with emeralds or other minerals, that but especially diamonds, which are formed in outer space. Okay, so now what I'm going to do is go back to the beginning. And when I was very young, I was very inquisitive, and I really didn't have much to deal with in terms of, like, kids today have toys, or educational toys, but I didn't have any. I grew up in a very poor environment. My dad had just gotten out of World War II. We went to a small town, brothers and sisters and the family, and I was 1 year old. So when I grew up, we lived in a house. We had food. It was warm. We had clothes, but that was it. We didn't have toys. We didn't have a lot of things for mental stimulation. So I made things. I would take cereal boxes and cut them out and make little cars. And one time when I was young, I made an airplane. And I put little electric motors in it and batteries. And I thought that this could fly. Well, at the time, the battery technology was very rudimentary. And the motor technology was very rudimentary, and this thing would just not get off the ground. In fact, it wouldn't even move. But I'd already had the wheels turning. And I would work on, and it was about probably fifth grade until I started realizing, and the teachers started realizing that I had talent in mathematics. It was, of course, physics at that point was a high school topic, a senior in high school topic. But clearly I had talent in mathematics. And at around eighth grade, ninth grade, somewhere in there, I started, in when I'd go into a math class, algebra or geometry or whatever, I would write my own book, my own theorems. And the teachers really, they didn't know what I was doing, but I always had 100 on the tests. And so at that early stage, I was already putting together my own constructs. And so I think it was something of a heralding of what would come in the future. But then when I got to high school, it was there that I learned about what I just call the prime number problem, the problem of prime numbers, which was an issue that was raised by the Greeks. If you take six things, you can put them in two rows and two columns with three deep, or you could put it in three columns with two deep. But if you take one of those away, you have five, there's no way to make them into orderly rows and columns. One is missing. So those numbers were recognized by the Greeks because they just couldn't figure out how to organize these. In other words, they did not have subproducts. They did not have numbers that multiplied together to equal them. And that was the original definition of prime numbers. But there was a problem with prime numbers because there was no way to really estimate where they were. You could have rudimentary methods of figuring out the first few, or up to 100 or 1,000, whatever algorithm, how far you wanted to go mechanically. But there was no way to, when you went way out there, is this number here prime or is it not prime? And there'd be some certain rules, like if it ended in a 7, then would it be prime? Well, it's a number 27 is not prime. The number 37 is prime. So how do you determine if a number is prime or not? And so this is a problem that stayed with me for my entire life until I finally solved it. It was in, I would have been potentially in my 50s or 60s when it first started to come together what was going on. But anyway, I'll be talking about that later. But it was at this early age that I started to already peg some of the problems that I would work on. When I got to college, the first year, second year of college, it was physics 101 and mechanics and celestial mechanics and differential equations and standard mathematics for a physics major. But I did something. Once I started taking mathematics courses, I just kept taking them. So I ended up with a double major. I had a major in physics and a major in mathematics. And so that was relatively difficult, especially when you get up to junior and senior years, when any one of those majors would have been enough to keep most people busy. And so I took a lot of other courses, like as very specialized courses, like the study of infinities. George Cantor was the author of a book, and that was a whole course. It was a very small book, Understanding the Concept of Infinities, which would later play in the course of my work with prime numbers. But then did various algebras, abstract algebra and linear algebra and matrix algebra and mathematical analysis and other topics, which I ended up teaching. Once I got to teaching at the university level, I was able to teach these topics in mathematics. So I ended up, when I eventually became old enough to teach in a university setting, I was teaching all of the math courses that I had taken. So there was calculus and engineering calculus and electricity. I eventually was teaching also electronics, the electronics of transistors and solid-state electronics. And I grew up, interestingly enough, when I went to college, we were still using tubes. So a lot of the equipment I used in my first couple of years of college were tubes, the old World War II evacuated vacuum tubes, diodes and triodes and amplifiers and amplification circuits using vacuum tubes, and then transitioned to transistors. And there, you know, this is something too. This is becomes irritating. You have people who say, "Oh, aliens gave us transistor technology." Well, no. You can see where the gates and the PN junctions and how they put those together, and then realized that you could use those in a transistor. And that had many functions like switching and amplification and other uses when you put those into useful circuits and put a bias on the transistor in certain ways. So I saw this develop piece by piece by piece. My first computer that I used was in college. It was an IBM 1130, I believe it was the name of it. But it had punch cards, and you would put in a program, and it was very limited in memory. I think it was like 8 kilobits or 8 kilobytes of memory, which is nothing compared to the little memory sticks you have today, etc. But it was had limitations. And I wrote programs that and would type them in. But this was a good training because it taught me about the rudimentary building blocks of computers. And so I saw the transistors come from little cans with 3 little wires coming out, which I used. And eventually also when I finally was at Cornell, I criticized this is one of the things that got me in trouble there, is I was working as in the electronics course, which was a higher level. This was a sophomore or junior level elective course for physics majors. And they wanted me to cut all the wires and have all of the experiments set up in this big, kind of like a stock room with little boxes. And there would be all of the experiments, say 10 experiments of a certain experiment would be all set up with the wires cut and everything in place. And the students would have their little lab manual and they'd come in, they'd plug everything together, take the measurements and leave. And I told the guy who designed this electronics course, I said I didn't think it was an educational experience because the students should learn the size wire to cut, how long to cut it, how to the proper way to wire a rheostat, for example, which is a variable resistor with 3 leads, and if you wire it incorrectly, you can burn it out. So I said, this is and when I was in college, we made our own experiments. We made our amplifiers. We made everything out of rudimentary parts. And so cutting a wire, you couldn't put a small wire where you had a big current. You had to calculate the current load and have the proper size wire, the proper size length, the proper size stripping, the proper size connection at the end. And when the students came in to Cornell in the lab, they didn't have any of this experience. They just plugged things in, because everything was pre-cut and in this little package. And so what I realized is that I had a very good sound education in terms of the building blocks, and that came into play when I later had real-world jobs because I worked in the telecommunications industry for 25 years. 10 of those years were at a high-level design of what are known as front-end processors, IBM telecommunications processors, very complex computers that offloaded the legacy IBM mainframes from their telecommunication task. And so this beginning that I had was a very good sound education because I knew how things worked. I knew how to design circuitry, and I worked with the electrical engineers. And my job was to start with a hardware specification, the functional specification, and that defined the instruction sets. We made our own chips. We made our own processor chips with instruction sets were optimized for telecommunications, etc. I belonged to committees like the 602 committees for Ethernet. I worked on those committees and as part of my job. And now when you plug a computer cable in from your router to your computer, that Ethernet cable standard is something that I worked on, along with hundreds and hundreds of other engineers. I wasn't the only one. I was part of a large, basically international team that went and knew that these protocols would be used far into the future. And people just take it for granted now that the Ethernet is, they don't even think about it. What's going on in that wire that makes transmission error-free. day in and day out. Well, that's because there's a protocol that's very well set, and the chips and the protocol managers, the software and hardware, are very well defined. And that's what we did back in those days. But at any rate, the other thing that I started when I was in college was understanding the in-body problem. In many aspects of physics, there, whenever you have two things, you can usually calculate the equations of motion or the force equations, etc. And you can determine the outcome in all the way to infinity, as long as there's no friction or there's no other forces involved to change the system. But you can calculate by analytical equations the future and the past, if you'd like. But if you get up to three bodies, all of a sudden it becomes complicated and it's not analytically solvable anymore. And I thought, gee, you know, these are two major problems of physics and mathematics. One is the n-body problem in physics. It has to do with gravity, and it could be also in quantum mechanics, where you have three bodies or n bodies in a quantum mechanical system, and you have differential equations that describe all of the forces and the dynamics, but you can't solve it analytically. So what people then turn to is digital processing. But digital processing has some limitations, mainly that you have errors that accumulate, and after a while, the accumulated errors become bigger than the movement or whatever you're calculating, and so they go off into never-never land. So the analytical solution is really desirable, but it never was solved. And so those were two big problems that I worked on simultaneously. And it was advancements that I made when I was studying the n-body problem that finally allowed me to solve the prime number problem. It's called the generator function. And so anyway, these are things that took a number of years to develop. But what I did when I studied physics is I didn't just solve the problem in the back of the book, get an answer. Okay, the answer matches what's in the book, the right number or the right answer or the whatever it was. The right equation or whatever the problem was requesting. I didn't do that. I went way beyond that. And I would imagine this, and I would imagine the equations and how they looked in three-dimensional space or two-dimensional space. And what were their limitations? And if you went out to infinity or if you went up to, say, relativistic speeds, what would happen? And so I was always pushing the limits of what I was doing, but in this process, I was developing a very good intuitive sense for how things worked. I could see them in my mind. I could see the equations, etc. And there were people I know that if you asked them a question in physics, they'd start writing down equations. And what I did is I had a visualization of what was going on in the equations. I could visualize these things in the interactions. And so that helped me eventually when I was doing the work on comets to understand the electric fields and how the electric fields would work along with gravitational fields and how the magnetic fields coupled into this. And so that's the next thing I'll be talking about here is how I spent a number of years. Now, I'll give you the time frame also from my education. When I got out of high school, I went directly to college, private four-year, very strict boys Catholic college. And one thing I did there, after I got there and I got away from home and high school and all the influences of my youth, is I sat down and I mentally dismantled everything that I thought I knew. And I said, I'm going to do this as an exercise, and now I'm going to start putting things back together that I understand and that I know to be true, and question things that I know that maybe are questionable. So college for me was not a party time like it is for a lot of people. It was some very serious study time. And the other thing that happens if you're in the winter time in Minnesota in a private school, like I was, and I had an office in the physics building, so I would do my studying there where it was extremely quiet. And I should go back also into high school. When I was in high school, I had a room in the house, upper part of the house and all the way in the front, which was a big room, and it was a big old house. And I had this room all to myself, and I had a big desk that my dad had procured for me. And then it was an old desk, so we resurfaced it. We put like a hard, like a pressed board type of thing on it. It was very hard surface. And then it had a lot of shelves up above because it was used like an industrial setting. And so it had lots of compartments and places to store my books and organize, etc. And a big work area, so I could draw. And when I was doing physics problems, etc. So the point is that in the middle of winter time, in Minnesota, in high school, this was in a small town. It was perfectly quiet. There was the traffic would, you know, any traffic that minor amount of traffic may have ended, you know, like 6 PM. And so long, long hours. There was no TV. There were no cell phones, of course. There was a phone in the house. There was one phone that was a landline, which mainly was used by parents. But if I had friends and we wanted to get together, I'd make a couple calls, you know, but it was nothing like chat or on the phone. It was simply rarely used, in fact. So anyway, it was very different. And so the amount of time I was had to concentrate, I also had a piano. And in the school band, I learned how to play the bass violin, classical. And so anyway, that was something when I finally got to college, I played in a number of bands. And so anyway, it was something that helped me earn money when I was in college. And by the way, these were not rock and roll bands. These were jazz bands and other forms of serious music, classical and jazz and other types of music. And so that gave me something, a diversion also from studying. And but anyway, I used the classical education in playing the bass violin as a way of earning money and having a diversion in college, and also very good friends and camaraderie with the people in the music groups. But anyway, college was a time when I had long, long periods of time to study. And it was difficult. I mean, it was, and I would have to say that you have to be almost a little bit, I wouldn't say crazy, but I would say the average person just cannot spend that amount of time in disciplined study. Most people just, they just can't do that. And so, and especially as I got to be junior and senior, doing a double major, math and physics, it was, you know, having 5 courses, which were high-level courses, all of them, you know, major field, and I had all my electives done. And so it was very intense. And to be at the top of my class in all of those classes all at the same time, and what I would do also is I would be ahead of the class. I would be a month or two ahead of the class. I would be reading the books. I'd be studying other information related to the classes. So when I went into class, I knew what was being taught. It was like, for me, it was like old information. And so the professors knew that. They could not make any mistakes because I was on top of it. And senior year in college, thermodynamics was our last class. There were 9 physics majors. I should mention this too. When I was a freshman in college, there were 42 physics majors. And went in there, and this was a medium-sized lecture hall, and the teacher came in, the professor came in. He said, "Look around, by the end of this first semester, there will only be 10 of you left." And I'm like, holy cow. And it was true. They were dropping like flies. People that came from, they thought they were going to be physics majors, and they weeded them out. They weeded them out. It was not easy. And of the 9 physics majors that remained, all 9 of them graduated and went on to further studies. But the point was that in the wintertime, there again, in the wintertime in Minnesota, when it's cold out, it's rather easy to sit in a study type atmosphere. And the same, for example, when I was at Cornell, I spent long, long periods of time in the libraries. And I one time asked the secretary of the astronomy department, I said, why don't I ever see any of the big professors? You know, Carl Sagan was there, all of these other highfalutin, you know, NASA scientists were at Cornell. I said, I never see these people ever in the library. Why is that? And she said, oh, they're too important to go to the library. They already know everything. I guarantee you, they didn't know jack. These guys were very pompous, very, very big egos, and really did not know much at all. What they did know was totally incorrect, which I later found out. But anyway, very interesting. But the wintertime at Cornell, once again, was a place where people were very serious. The students, you know, would party on the weekend and things like that. But during the week, it was very serious studying, very serious business. And so a very good environment. But my own college years, I had an office in the physics department and also access to the upperclassmen. When I was a freshman and sophomore and junior, there were people that were very good physicists. All of them went on to physics careers, went to graduate school, got PhDs, etc. And so I was surrounded by people who were very good at physics. And one thing is that physics jokes, not many people would laugh at physics jokes, but there's a way to find humor in physics. And so it's a very strange, bizarre type of humor. But anyway, there was, you know, there's a lot of camaraderie in the physics department and in the library, the physics library, which was in the physics building. The physics building, it was the entire middle floor of the science building. And we had a director who was extremely strict. There was no messing around. And especially when you were building experiments or doing something in the laboratory, it was all business. It was all business. And we had our own machine shop. We had a Christian brother who was an expert at machining, and he would design. We would design the experiments, and he would build them in the shop. So taking steel or aluminum or whatever the materials were, plastics, whatever it took, and put them together in an experiment, and we actually built the classical experiments of physics in the shop and then ran them and got the data results, etc. So it was a very good education, very strict adherence to the classical education books, and something that I realized, like when I was at Cornell, they did not get, because there were, in a lot of cases, the tenured or the pre-tenured professors who were teaching the classes were not interested in teaching. They were interested in going in, spending their hour in class, and getting out of there as fast as they could, because they had to write papers, get grants, and establish their careers, which was far more important to them than teaching these underclassmen. So there was a real stark difference between my education in college and that of an undergrad at Cornell. I had a much, much better education, and in physics and in mathematics. I can't say mathematics was very rigorous at Cornell, but the physics was almost canned, let me put it that way, especially on the experimental side. Okay, so just a few things here, a few other points to make. when I got done with college, I graduated, and I got three offers for graduate funding to go to graduate school to get my PhD. And I realized that I had just really, I really needed to do something different. And so I called up the one school that I had chosen to go to grad school. I called them up and I said, look, you know, I'm really not ready to go yet. And they said, that's perfectly fine. We will hold your funding to get your PhD for a period of 3 years. So you can come back at any time in the next 3 years, just walk in the door, we'll give you your position here as a graduate student, no questions asked. And I thought, wow, that's a good offer. So I'm going to take this opportunity. And I ended up going to Mexico. And I waited till around the fall of the year and the snow, etc. And I finally, I was in Minnesota and I left. I left Minnesota and I went south and got to the Texas border. And there I got on a bus, a big bus that took me from the Texas border down to Mexico City. And there I ended up getting a job teaching in a high school. And so anyway, that was my actual first job after college. And so I went back to the U.S. and I started in the next fall. So I basically had a year off. And what I did that summer is something that I did a lot in my youth, is I went up into the Canadian wilderness and lived, basically, something I eventually learned how to do. And at first, it's a little bit scary not having everybody there, your support system, etc., being on my own and having to take care of myself on a daily basis, but an extremely healthy environment. And the other thing it did is it taught me the ability to connect into it's like a universal consciousness, and you start to have realizations. There's certain aspects. For example, this helped me solve the prime number problem, because what I learned is that in nature things are very simple, but a lot of times in their simplicity they're very complicated also. And so having a good background in physics and mathematics, etc., I knew that, for example, with the prime numbers, when I eventually got to the point of actually solving the prime number issue of organizing the prime numbers and calculating them directly, that in nature, you can have confidence that the designer put order into things. It's just that we are not able to see them. So the mathematical tools that existed up to that point in time were not allowing people to understand the prime numbers. And as I later found out, one of the biggest hindrances to understanding prime numbers was the base 10 number system, or the base modulo. So base 6, base 8, base 9, base 10, base 20, base 27, whatever. These modulo systems of mathematics and numbers were really a giant hindrance to understanding. And I went back and I could see the great mathematicians like Gauss, one of the greatest mathematicians, or Euler, or these other people, or Riemann, and they never got to understand prime numbers because they did not have that connection that I had to it's universal consciousness is not... It might have too many other ramifications, like maybe in yoga or things like that. There are other activities where people do reach a certain level of consciousness, and that's something that's very important. You have to understand that the universe is a very complex place, but very simple. And so being away for that long period of time in the wilderness by myself There were times when I would go back to the metropolitan area, pick up a friend or two and take them up and go camping for a week, but they had to get back. They had jobs, etc. And I was always fairly independent. I didn't always have a lot of money, but I was able to manage my money so that I could have independence. But it was those long periods of time, once again, out in the wilderness. And you'll find that all of the great prophets spent time in the wilderness. And you might think, well, that's a giant waste of time. You could be earning money. You could be getting a job. You could be doing all kinds of things. You could be furthering your education. You could be reading books. You could be doing all kinds of things that would, you know, in modern life, you would consider to be beneficial. So to just simply go out into the wilderness and just live out there on a basic rudimentary level day after day for long periods of time for months on end doesn't seem to the average person to be productive. But the real situation is if you don't do that, you will never, ever be a great physicist. Because there are good physicists, there are well-educated physicists, they have patents, they design things, they can build rockets, they can do all kinds of things, but they'll never be a great physicist when it comes to theoretical, the workings of the universe, because they don't have that connection. And it's not something you get by reading in a book or sitting in your office in a university or writing papers that get published in peer-reviewed journals. None of those things will get you to the point where you are connected with the designer. There are other physicists who have talked about this. Albert Einstein talked about it. Stephen Hawking talked about it in one of his books. He talked about discovering the secrets of the universe and how that if a physicist got to the end of his life and made even one discovery of how the universe worked, of the subtleties of the universe, it would be a great achievement. And the same way with Nikola Tesla. And a lot of times, I remember when I was a kid, they would say, oh, Albert Einstein is an atheist. Well, no, he was not an atheist. He just didn't belong to an organized religion. There's a difference. Somebody who believes in a designer and a great design in the universe is different than somebody that belongs to a religion, an organized set of rules and hierarchy, etc., that are directed towards appreciating or honoring God, etc. But a scientist who does not belong to an organized religion, that doesn't mean he's an atheist. In fact, there are a lot of scientists who are atheists who believe that evolution and the Big Bang, and you don't need God or a great designer, it all just happened at random. And when people die, their bodies go away to dust, and that's the end of it. That's what they think. And let me tell you, if you were a creator and you created this massive universe with all of its order and everything, and you had people whose only purpose in life was simply to turn around and thank the creator and just, in a sense, worship him and give thanks to him. And that's all it is, because the universe is infinite in size and extent and in time and the future and past. And so how is a lowly person that only lives less than 100 years going to accomplish anything in this universe? And the most you can do is, like Einstein or Stephen Hawking said, is to make some realizations of how things work. And that would be a big accomplishment because of the level of complexity of the universe, etc. So Newton or the mathematicians or other people throughout history making one discovery at a time through laborious work or like Kepler, you know, working out the orbits of the planets to understand that they're ellipses, and in a lot of cases not perfect circles, or comets, the orbits of comets, etc. But the point is that you have to have a very, it's a spiritual connection with the universe and with your creator to really appreciate. Because if you don't have that, then you're just going through the mechanical motions. I was talking earlier about my senior class in thermodynamics, and I didn't finish that story. There was the 4 years of physics, and I was doing a double major in mathematics, but in the physics department, there was another student who was literally valedictorian of the entire school. He had a 4.0 average in all the other classes. I had 4.0 average in physics and math, but I did not have 4.0 average in all my other classes, which to me was fine. I was concentrating on physics and mathematics. And so anyway, we're in a senior's thermodynamics class. It was the last class of the year. And this head of the physics department came in. He says, I'm going to give one A in this class at the end of the semester. And so this guy went into a fever pitch. He worked all of the problems in the back of the book. He read the books. He went over everything twice with a fine-tooth comb. And we came into the final exam in thermodynamics. And the professor came up and he wrote something on the board and walked out. And this guy screamed out, he says, that's not in the book. He realized that, and I looked at it, and I had to basically take something that none of us had ever seen before and use what we learned to build a solution. I got the A, and it ruined this guy's valedictorian status in the school. Another student had 4.0 average, and so my classmate in physics got a B. It was the only B he ever got in his life, in grade school, high school, and college. It's the only B. And he didn't go on in physics. He went on into medicine. A great student and everything, but doing all of the problems in the back of the book and learning everything in the book, he didn't learn how to think with the material that was in the book. And that's something that I did, because that was the way I learned. I learned because I could analyze things and look at things and look at problems that I'd never seen before and build an approach. And in studying physics, and once I started making the major discoveries in astronomy, astrophysics, and space science, what I realized is that, and this is also essential, is first of all, you have to know what the unsolved problems are, or you have to know what things have solutions which are not real solutions. They're interim solutions, or they're solutions that are not solutions. So you have to decide on that. But you have to know what the question is. And then you have to go out and learn everything you can about the subject, and then look at all of those factors. Let me give an example. My first paper that I published was on galactic formation. And one of the big issues with galactic formation was symmetry, although nobody recognized it. And when I went out and I started studying the photos of galaxies, I looked at them and I said, well, there's symmetry here, but then I got very specific and looked at hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of galaxies, and I would take a ruler and I'd lay it down on the photograph and I'd take the center of the galaxy, put it in the middle of the ruler, and then I would measure out from the center. And if there was a star cluster on one side of the nucleus out in an arm, there would be a star cluster on the other side exactly the same distance from the nucleus. Or if there was a gap, or if there was some kind of feature or a string or a warping or any other feature that was in the arm of the galaxy, it was reflected in the other side. And now these are things that are separated by 100,000 light years, tremendous distances between these. So how did the arm over here know what the arm over there was doing? And it actually turns out that the same problem occurs in the formation of snowflakes, something that I've also worked on, and from a mathematical point of view. How come snowflakes are perfectly six-sided symmetric? How does that work? What's going on? How come the arm of the snowflake over here knows exactly what the arm of the other five arms are doing, and they're all building the same. So galaxies was a special problem. And the standard theory for galaxy formation was the clump of material in outer space would have an impulse from some passing object. And that impulse was supposed to set up a gravitational wave, and that gravitational wave became the arms and the spiral arms of the galaxy, etc. And so anyway, I looked at that and I said, well, that's ridiculous, because if you had a perfect symmetry of the incoming mass that was going to influence the galaxy, then potentially you could have symmetry.
But the issue is that in 99.999% of the cases, you would never have a perfect symmetrical incoming object. It would be coming in at all different angles. So you would not be able to set up your gravity wave in a symmetrical manner. So 99.99% of all galaxies cannot be explained simply from an aspect of symmetry. There's another problem. It's called the galaxy problem, commonly known that in Big Bang theory, where the results of the measurement of the background radiation don't show the necessary gaps that would allow for galaxies to form. So it's one of the things they've been wrestling with, and every 10 years somebody comes out with some bogus hypothesis or something, and everybody cheers. Anyway, this has been going on for over 100 years. So academia is simply in la-la land. Albert Einstein said it. Nikola Tesla said it. I say it, if that helps. That standard astrophysical theory is just garbage. It doesn't work. And so they don't even recognize the issue of symmetry, the problems in galactic formation. So anyway, at this point in the show, I'm going to take a little caveat, because everybody I know that I contact, I mean, I have contacts all over the world, has this cold, let's call it, or flu symptoms, or whatever you want to call it in your own language. But everybody has this. And what's going on right now is we are getting the initial, started a number of days ago, the contact with the Venus, the tail of Venus, which we get a dose of influenza every time Venus has an inferior conjunction. And everybody I know has it. And so that's something that I talk about in my work. I've talked about it many times. It's in the medical literature, and it was first noticed by the Chinese. I've talked about this on other radio shows, where we are influenced by this inferior conjunction of Venus. And so that's why I sound kind of like a frog in this episode of this programming. My very first show of my history is being affected by theoretical work that I developed. And, of course, this phenomenon empirically was known about since the 1200s. Like I say, it's been published in the medical journals. Venus also has other effects, like an increase in solar activity during this inferior conjunction, but nobody makes any explanation as for why that is. Why would we have influenza during an inferior conjunction of Venus? Well, my work explains it, and that's the issue. A lot of these things have been noticed before. The heads of comets shrinking as they approach the sun, the influenza that happens during the inferior conjunction of Venus, the creation of the influx of massive streams of diamonds coming from outer space during mass extinctions. All of these things have been noticed before, but nobody ever had an explanation. That's why the Russian scientists in the mid-1990s at the University of Novosibirsk noticed my work, and we started a very fruitful exchange of information, where daily they translated my work. We had a translator, and they translated my work, and then we studied it and went back and forth. And some of the emails with that exchange are in the rear of my book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather, in which they understood that my work explains a tremendous amount of what they were observing. So the observations in a lot of cases existed before, but nobody knew why that was. Or the Tunguska event, they're still grabbing at straws in standard science. They found a little lake 5 miles away just recently, and they go, oh, that could be it. It could be where the meteor hit. Well, wait, 5 miles away, this is a area in Russia where the trees are blown down and burned down for 20 miles around in all directions and from a central point. And in that central point, there's nothing. There's no hole. There's no meteor impact. And so what it was an electrical discharge. And it came from a passing comet. The natives report seeing the sky brighten for all the nights prior to that event. And then the boom, the explosion, broke windows 100 miles away. But when you go to this epicenter of where all the trees are blown down, there's nothing. And these scientists from the University of Novosibirsk were there. They were atmospheric scientists who were studying this phenomenon. And so anyway, they realized that my work also explained that. Why would there be an electrical discharge of that proportion in a remote area of Russia? And it fits with the description of the local people. So anyway, this is a first introduction into my history. And you can see that with all the anecdotes and other things that have happened during my life, that this is going to take me literally all year to cover the history of my work. And so this week, I gave you a little bit of an introduction. Next week, I'll be talking about how I first began putting electromagnetic fields with gravitational fields and understanding the subtleties and the misnomers that were already in place from standard astronomy, misunderstandings, and just complete ridiculous statements that had no physics. But just remember, most even astrophysicists have very poor physics backgrounds. Is for certain, astronomers and space scientists stop taking physics too early. They don't have a good physics background, whereas I do. And so when I remember talking to these people, like when I was at Cornell, they were idiots. They just didn't know anything. All they knew was their little set of rules, and everything had to fit in those boxes. So I'm just about out of time with this show. Thank you for listening. Remember, my webpage is jmccsci.com. It's the main webpage, the water filter page, jmccwaterfiltersplural.com. And remember, you have a coupon code for 10% off JMCC if you buy water filter products from the jmccwaterfilters.com webpage. And hopefully I'll be back with my voice next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we're at the crossroads. Good night.